when you have elevated levels of ketones in the blood, the way that the body normally stops ketone levels getting too high is that ketones are part of a what's called a feedback loop. So as ketone levels go up, they actually act to slow down fat release from the adipocytes. And that in turn would naturally decrease ketone production because there'd be less fat released from the adipocytes. That fat wouldn't be going to the liver and there'd be less ketone production. There's a negative feedback loop. So as ketone levels go up, ketones themselves inhibit their own production. So when you drink an exogenous ketone and you elevate your ketones in the blood, you're going to be in the short term blunting that fat release, that lipolysis component.
Welcome to episode 19 of Imperfect Progress. Today we are talking all things ketosis. And if you've ever been confused about the difference between nutritional ketosis achieved through a ketogenic diet and ketosis from ingesting ketone supplements, which are two very different scenarios, you've come to the right place. Today's guest is Dr. Brianna Stubbs, and she is a world expert in ketone metabolism from ketone supplementation and how this supplementation can impact performance, resilience, and also health span. She completed her PhD in metabolic physiology at the University of Oxford, and she studied the metabolism and application of ketone salts and ester supplements, and we'll definitely differentiate between those today. She was also a member of the British international rowing team, and she was a two-time world champion lightweight athlete. So she definitely understands the importance of optimizing the body for sports performance. Brianna spent 2 years as research lead at San Francisco startup, where she helped to launch the world's first commercially available ketone ester drink and set up a collaboration with the U.S. Special Operations Command to investigate the effects of ketone drinks on physical and cognitive performance in extreme environments. Super interesting work. Dr. Stubbs is currently the lead transitional scientist at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, where she's part of a team that is focused on developing our understanding of ketone biology, the metabolic effects of novel ketone supplements, and the translation of those findings into tools for implementation as part of a holistic approach to healthy aging. So today we discuss the physiology related to ketone production in the body as a result of a ketogenic diet and how that impacts fat utilization. And we talk about that in comparison to the potential health benefits that you could achieve through ketone supplementation. So we get really clear on the different types of ketone supplements, because if you've ever gone shopping, you'll notice that the price range is from $25 to $2,500. So we talk about why. We also touch on how long ketone supplements last in the body. We narrow in on the optimal dosing when taking supplements, and that's super important because you don't want to waste your money. And also how supplementing impacts our body's own ketone production and whether you can consume ketones in too high of an amount from a safety perspective and what that would look like medically. We spend the first portion of today's podcast kind of looking at the data surrounding athletic performance in ketone supplementation, including their potential role in recovery. And then we move on to the brain and some super interesting new findings related to brain health and healthy aging, and in particular, some brain diseases and even the potential for ketone supplements or a ketogenic diet to help with traumatic brain injury. So this is all a super interesting area of research that I think has a ton of promise from what Dr. Stubbs said today. So I don't want to give away any of the insights, so let's just step inside and put some of these social media myths to rest about ketogenic diets and ketone supplements, and make sure you're not wasting your money. Let's go and listen to the expert herself, Dr. Brianna Stubbs. I'll see you inside. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Stubbs. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Lovely to talk to you today, Anne.
You as well. Well, I've been really excited about this conversation because this is a really hot topic, as you know, And when I'm out there reading about ketones and ketogenesis on the internet, I've noticed that there's a lot of myths and misinformation in particular around the differences between nutritional ketosis and the state of ketosis that we're able to bring our bodies into through supplementation of ketones. So I'm really excited to first have you work through some of the common terminology that gets thrown around when we're having discussions about ketogenic diets and ketone supplements, and then even to have you walk us through the different types of ketone supplements and the data around them in regards to performance and also in regards to brain health. And I know that, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've spent many years researching in this area. So I just knew that you would be the perfect guest to have on.
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. And you must call me out if I start going too deep in the weeds at any point, but I'll do my best.
No problem. So yeah, I would love to start just by covering some of the common terminology that does get used when discussions are happening about ketone supplementation. And in particular, maybe if we could start with, you know, how do we make our own ketones and get into a state of ketogenesis or nutritional ketosis? And how is that different from the state that we can get into through consumption of ketones?
Okay. So that's the perfect place to start. So in our bloodstream and in our body, we make and get exposed to three different ketone bodies. So they're three different distinct chemicals, and they're all lumped together under the sort of common name of ketone bodies. Firstly is beta hydroxybutyrate, and you might see that written as BHB. It's an abbreviation. The second is acetoacetate, and the third is acetone, and that's the one that we can smell on the breath of someone who is having who's in ketosis, and perhaps a type 2 diabetic might have a very strong acetone smell on their breath if they're in ketoacidosis. So those are the three chemicals we're talking about when we're thinking about ketone bodies. Ketone bodies are made in the liver, and they are made from fat. So what happens is when you don't eat any or have eaten very low amount of dietary carbohydrate, or if you're just starving and fasting altogether, then insulin levels are low, carbohydrate intake is low, glycogen is depleted, that stored carbohydrate, and the body starts to look for alternative sources of energy to keep organs going that really normally rely on carbohydrate. And evolutionarily, that was the brain. So the brain, fats can't cross the brain. Glucose is a very major fuel source for the brain. And when we start running out of carbohydrate stored in our body, that starts to be a bit of a risk to our brain function. And so ketone production evolved as a way to make fats digestible and metabolizable by the brain. So insulin's down, dietary carbohydrates down, glycogen is down, and that releases the handbrake on fat breakdown, this process called lipolysis. And this means that fat is released from our adipose tissue, and it goes into the bloodstream, and from the blood there it goes into the liver, and the liver can undertake this process called ketogenesis, so generating ketones from fat. The liver is the only organ in the body that doesn't use ketones for energy. So once the liver has made ketones, it spits them back out into the bloodstream, and then the ketones are in the bloodstream and they can travel to the brain and the muscle and the heart, all these other organs which can consume ketones as a fuel. So that is how we naturally get into ketosis through changes in our diet, whether that's lowering carbohydrate intake or straight out starving, fasting, restricting calories altogether. The medical definition of ketosis or hyperketonemia, like elevated levels of blood ketones, is typically a level of ketones in the blood that is over 0.5 millimolar. Interestingly, and we could talk about this later, we still don't really know if there is a threshold effect for levels of blood ketones, and it probably depends on your end goal and your use case, as it were, for ketones. But that 0.5 is typically considered a cutoff for being in nutritional ketosis. So in the process of endogenous ketosis is what I just described, endo within, genus, originating from or generated by. Endogenous ketosis means that the ketones are generated inside the body, and you have that process of fat burning, lipolysis, ketogenesis in the liver, hyperketonemia in the blood and ketosis in the blood, and then that facilitates ketone oxidation and ketone metabolism in the periphery. So it's a multi-step process. So exogenous ketosis, exo outside of genus, generated in, exogenous ketosis means that the ketones in the blood have come from outside of the body. So we don't have lipolysis. We don't necessarily have liver generations of ketones, but we do have elevated levels of ketones in the blood and elevated levels of ketones being burnt as a fuel, ketone oxidation. We can get into exogenous ketosis by consuming ketone esters, ketone salts, all of these ketone supplements that are available now. And that means that you don't have to make any changes to your diet necessarily to be in ketosis. So a lot of the studies that I've done, you would have an athlete who's on a high carb diet and you'll give them a ketone drink. And then within 30 minutes, it'll look like they've been fasting or starving for a week because their ketone levels will be 2 or 3 millimolar just from having one of these ketone drinks. But an important point is that the ketone levels are not, because they're not coming from within the body, they're just coming from the supplement that you just consumed. It typically only lasts a few hours before your body is burnt off the ketones and then you're back into not being in ketosis. So there's quite a lot of differences between endogenous ketosis resulting from prolonged dietary carbohydrate restriction and exogenous ketosis, which is typically kind of acute and occurs just a few hours after consuming a ketone supplement.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. Thanks so much for explaining that so clearly. And I think you made a really good point, and one that maybe often gets lost, about the fact that when you're consuming them from a supplement exogenous, that you're not increasing that lipolysis in the way that you are when you get there through your dietary restriction of carbohydrates.
Exactly.
When you go to Google, so I purposely went to Google before this podcast and I just pretended I was a consumer and I put in ketone supplements. And there I got a list of the top 21 ketone supplements. And they range from $25 to $2,500. So
crazy.
So that's a really big range. So I think this would be another great thing to break down before we start maybe getting into the research, because when we do talk about some of the data, it's going to be so important that we discuss which type of ketone was used in the research, so that someone listening doesn't think, oh, I can just go buy the $25 one, and you know, I might see that type of or feel what those participants felt. So, could you speak to the different types of ketone supplements and why the wide range of prices?
Yeah. So, really, the headline thing to look for when you're going on Google and buying an exogenous ketone supplement is what level of ketones that supplement is able to deliver. And that's going to depend on the compound that is in the supplement, but also the dose or the serving size as well. Because there's a lot of research that's been done using ketone products that can get ketone levels really high. And that's where we tend to see some positive results in terms of athletic performance or cognitive performance as well. We see better results with, generally speaking, slightly higher levels of ketones, as well as products that don't really elevate ketones very much, we just don't tend to see positive results from those studies. So the BHB delivery, the ketone delivery from the ketone supplement, is one of the most important things. Generally speaking, there are two main types of true exogenous ketones, and that would be, as you mentioned, ketone esters and ketone salts. And generally speaking, esters are more powerful at raising blood ketone levels and salt. So I actually just recently finished a bit of a literature review on this, and it seems as if ketone salts typically raise blood ketones up to that 0.5 millimole BHB threshold, and maybe up to 0.8 or 1 millimole of BHB. It's quite a small range, quite a tight range, and it doesn't really often exceed that 1 millimolar level of BHB. Just for context, if you were on a ketogenic diet or in full starvation, sort of a relatively natural plateau would be between 4 and 6 millimoles of ketones. But if ketones get much higher than that, if they say were to go over 10 millimolar, that would be start to be maybe dangerous and be like diabetic ketoacidosis. So with ketones, just like with glucose, there's a sort of a sweet spot where our body functions quite well. Too low, it's not going to do very much. At least, you know, you're not going to die from lack of ketones in the same way as you would with glucose. But there's a sweet spot where ketone levels are there enough and powerful enough to exert an effect. But if you go too high, that's not going to be good either. So with a ketone supplement, you're looking to get yourself into that sort of sweet spot range. And 1 millimole from a ketone salt, 0.5 to 1 millimole is a little on the low side. So we don't tend to see efficacy there. As whereas with the ketone esters that I've seen, there's several types of them. Maybe we leave that for another time, but typically the levels will be from at least 1 millimole all the way up to 5 or 6 millimoles, depending on how much is consumed. So generally speaking, an ester is going to be more powerful and more effective than a salt in terms of raising ketone levels.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you mentioned doses. So how would someone go about knowing the proper dose?
This is a really, really good question, and one I don't get asked that often. So I'm glad that you've asked it. So I like to think about ketones. And when your listeners are thinking about ketones, you have to think about it more like a macronutrient than as a traditional supplement. So, you know, when we're thinking about staging out carbohydrate intake, for sport anyway, we're thinking about getting 60 to 90 grams of carbs an hour when you're doing really intense activity. And it's not quite so much with ketones, but, you know, a typical supplement's only going to be a couple of milligrams. And for ketones, that's just not enough. So a typical serving of ketones is anywhere between 10 grams and 30 grams. So it's much more in the macronutrient kind of size. You can test the efficacy of the ketone supplement on yourself by using urine ketone sticks. I wouldn't really recommend that, but it's definitely the cheapest way of doing it. And you can you pee on the stick and you see it change color, and it'll tell you whether or not the product has achieved ketosis. But the best way, if you're not too squeamish, and nowadays actually the cost of these machines is not that high, but if you like to self-experiment, you can buy a handheld ketone meter, which is a bit like a handheld glucose meter that a diabetic would be using to check their blood sugar. I think you can get one with all of the test strips for under $50 now on the internet. And then you can maybe 30 minutes or an hour after you take a ketone supplement, you can actually measure ketones in your blood using a tiny little finger prick. It's not too painful, very quick. And you can actually see the levels of ketones in your blood change as a result of taking these supplements. So, you know, the absolute best way to kind of set up your dosing would be to do blood reading like that. The next best way would be to look at some of, you know, if you didn't mind getting down and dirty with the research, is to have a little look at some of the papers at the typical doses that we used in the studies where there were positive effects, which do tend to be on the higher side, more like 25 grams, you know, on the upper limit of what I was just discussing, 25 to 30 grams per serving of a ketone ester. And, you know, really, I guess another cautionary note I would say is, you know, these compounds are really powerful, and that's why they work. But it does mean that if you haven't tried them before, it's probably best not to do it on race day. It's just something that you should maybe try half a serving to start with, and then work up to two serving, you know, full serving or a serving and a half. But you know, these are not in the same way that you can get GI upset or feel a bit funny if you get your carbs or your caffeine a bit wrong. If you get your ketone dosing a bit wrong, it's going to make you feel a bit funky. So definitely experiment and don't just drop it straight in on an important performance day.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice. Like you said, for all supplements, try them out in training. The dosing, that was really useful. Something I wanted to ask you. So you said 10 to 30 grams for the esters, and for the salts, is it the same? Because I know that there's probably more GI upset, if I'm correct, with the salts.
Yeah, salts definitely, as you increase the serving size, there's more of a chance of GI upset. So you don't typically see people giving such high doses of the salt. And honestly, from some of my own research, when we were increasing the dosage, it just didn't seem to absorb as well. And you know, the way I was rationalizing that to myself is that if you have even more mineral and salt you know, in the gut, it's just the absorption, the gradient for diffusion is not going to be as good. So it didn't look right. like we had a good linear relationship between the amount that we gave and the amount of ketones in the blood. As whereas with ketone esters, if we double the dose, we typically see a doubling of the ketone levels in the blood. So it's nice dose response relationship that we don't see so much with the salts. Typically the salt products that are available on the internet now have what I would consider to be quite a low serving size to really have an effect. You know, as I think I mentioned to you before we started recording, sometimes I even see these little capsules of BHB that have maybe a gram in there, and eating a gram of sugar is not going to do that much for you. And I don't expect that eating a gram of ketones would do much for you either. So, you know, I think that really that lower limit of say 10 grams, it's probably going to be the minimum that you're going to take of an ester anyway and see any bump in ketones at all, which has got to be, is the main output marker for efficacy of these supplements.
Yeah, this is super important because, you know, without that knowledge, you could just be wasting money really and just taking you know, one or 2 grams and kind of hoping and maybe having a placebo effect, but who knows if you're not measuring anything. I have a question. Earlier you mentioned that, you know, the exogenous ketones you're taking, you know, through supplementation can only stay in your blood for several hours. So is the rate and time of that differ between a salt and an ester? How quickly they go in, how long they stay?
Definitely looks like absorption, so how quickly they get into the body might be different. But the off-ramp, the clearance from the body, is going to be more determined by that individual's metabolism and clearance of the ketones. So we tended to see that esters get into the body a little bit quicker than salts. The peak occurs slightly earlier in terms of the peak blood ketone levels. But then in terms of the elimination rate or the use of the ketones and the excretion of the ketones, oxidation, all of those things, it definitely seems like if you exercise, they'll disappear quicker because they're being consumed as a fuel source compared with at rest. And, you know, we're even seeing differences, and this is definitely not well established yet, but from what I see, you know, the bleeding edge of the literature, it looks like there's differences in ketone clearance from between people who are metabolically healthy and people who are diabetic and metabolically unhealthy. So I think that there's probably some metabolism component that also drives how quickly ketones are removed from the circulation after you ingest. I'm almost thinking about, I'd love to run a study where I do like, instead of doing an oral glucose tolerance test, which is the standard way of seeing if someone has diabetes, I'd love to be able to make it like an oral ketone tolerance test and try and figure out if there are phenotypes or characteristics that mean that some people are more quote unquote ketone sensitive or not, because we actually don't really know very much about the individual differences between people that might affect their ability to metabolize ketones. And another little tidbit, just because I like to nerd out, we actually also think that ketone sensitivity and ketone metabolism changes with age. So we saw in some animal experiments that we did, we were giving them a bolus of ketone ester, and it was very different between old mice and young mice having the same body weight adjusted amount of ketone ester. So I think, you know, maybe age has affected it, and that really relates to a lot of what I do now at the Buck and Institute for Research on Aging. So we just think about aging, but also health probably as well. And, you know, as I mentioned as well, activity will clear out ketones quicker. So it's not a question that has a very easy answer.
Mm-hmm. No, that's super fascinating. And do you think that when it comes to age, like, is there anything going on there with the digestion and your microbiome?
Possibly. So we do have collaborators at UCSF that found that feeding ketone esters could alter the gut microbiome in a way that was somewhat similar to the ketogenic diet, actually. So, I mean, I wouldn't rule out that ketone esters can impact the microbiome, and therefore, if you have just changes in your microbiome because of age, then, you know, the response might be different. It's definitely a lot of interrelated variables that it'll be difficult, and, you know, like the work of a many year research program to tease out all of these factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, hopefully you end up doing that research too.
It'll take a village. Hopefully there'll be lots of people doing it.
That's great. Well, this has been really good because we've been able to kind of break down a lot of the terminology, the different types of ketones and, you know, how they work differently in the body, the dose, which is super important, and then also different ways that anyone listening might want to measure to see if they're even, you know, getting enough ketones into their body and getting in the right state. And so from here, I really wanted to start off talking about performance and athletes, and then I really am interested to speak about the brain shortly after that, because I think that's fascinating. But I wanted to discuss, I mean, you have a really incredible history as an athlete. I know you've won several world championship medals as a rower and in the sculls, and you're still competing as a triathlete in the 70.3, which is amazing. So I'm going to guess that you have experienced supplementing with ketones. So that'll be interesting to get your perspective as well. But from a research perspective, for me as a sports nutritionist, what would be the perfect world would be if, let's say, road cyclists, so a sport that has endurance and intensity where someone's going to be consuming a fairly high carbohydrate diet, if on top of a carb load, they consumed exogenous ketones, that they could get an additional performance boost from that. So I'm really curious, as far as the research sits today, from what I understand, I'd love if you could talk about it. There isn't a lot of data to suggest that that scenario is really possible, that ketones are improving performance over and above what a carbohydrate load can do. But I have seen one study that you investigated cyclists during a 90-minute effort that did show performance improvements. And then I've seen others in time trialists where performance was actually impaired. Now, that might have been for GI reasons. You can definitely expand on that for me. So I'm hoping you could speak to, you know, why are we seeing differences in studies where participants are consuming carbohydrates? And what are some of those maybe unresolved questions?
Yeah, I guess the easiest place to start is when we look at these studies, we have to look at the compound, as you mentioned. A lot of work was done using ketone salts and found null results, you know, so no effect on performance, neither positive or negative. And I always think it's really important to actually emphasize that a null result isn't a good or a bad thing. And it's like, oh, it's not like they don't work in a bad way. It's just like, right, do anything. So lots of null results with ketone salts. Then we think about ketone esters. So there was one study that you just mentioned there in your question where the study used an acetoacetate ester, which up to the point of that study had never been tested in humans before. And they used a dosage which was matching of this other BHB-based ester that I worked on. So they sort of hot swapped the compound. BHB ester, swapped it for the acetoacetate ester, gave the same dosages, but it never really been piloted and tested and, you know, kind of made to be palatable and tolerable. And so they actually had a lot of GI issues, as you mentioned, in that study. And that wasn't really, it's hard to separate any ketone effect or even any compound effect from the effect of a poorly formulated, very bitter tasting drink that you give to people right before they go into intense exercise. So to me, it's like, you know, that study just reproved the point that if you make people feel sick, then they're not going to perform as well. And people were not feeling well because there wasn't a big foundation of work on how to formulate that compound in a way that made it palatable. So those are the two categories that we can sort of deal with kind of quickly and easily. Salts are not really raising ketone levels enough to, in my opinion, to improve performance. And there's not really been any consistent positive results of ketone salts. The study with that acetoacetate ester was quite confounded by the poor tolerability due to the lack of experience formulating that compound. And I mean, as you have to say, there's maybe only one other research study in humans of any kind at rest or during exercise has been done with that compound since. So it's not as well understood. Maybe, you know, in the future, we'll see more studies of it and it'll be better formulated. We get different results, but that's where we are with that one. The bulk of the work that I've been following and that I've been involved with is using a BHB-based ketone ester. So it's a BHB monoester. As you said, the very first research study that came out using that compound was the 30-minute time trial after a 60-minute pre-fatigue that was quite demanding. And we did see an improvement in performance there. But I guess, you know, in retrospect, looking at those studies, they were designed to be physiology studies that isolated the effects of ketones and tried to understand the metabolism. They were not designed to be ecological, athletic performance studies. So, and actually, I took part in not one of the studies that was in that paper, but a study that was a predecessor to one of the studies that was in that paper. And we, those of us that were subjects in that study, those studies, we would fast before we came to do the performance test. And then we would be given the study beverages that would be either ketones and carbs or just carbs, but you'd be coming in not having done your regular nutrition, having actually even fasted for a few hours beforehand. And I think that that's probably one of the key reasons why the results of subsequent studies have been less consistent and less less favorable for ketones. So that one study, I think what it showed me is that there are profound shifts in metabolism when you quickly raise ketones in athletes. You know, we saw consistently lower levels of lactate, we saw glycogen sparing, we saw differences in intramuscular triglyceride usage, but all of this is on the background of coming in fasted, but then being given directly before exercise, being given ketones and carbs or carbs alone. And so a lot of the studies that came after that were done by Brendan Egan and Mark Evans over in Dublin, and then also by Peter Hespel over in Louvain in Belgium. And they are both sort of much more like exercise, exercise performance and exercise physiology, much more applied laboratories. And so a lot of their work, they would actually bring people in and do a controlled meal feed, as well as the ketone plus carb drink, which, you know, as an athlete, you definitely, you're always going to have something to eat a couple of hours before you go and do your maximal performance. You're not going to fast for 8 hours before you do that. You know, in that regard, it's maybe it's unsurprising that ketones were better because they're a fasting metabolite. So you're going to, you know, you're going to be in more of a disadvantage coming into an intense bout fasted, as whereas in these other studies, they were fed a meal and then fed the ketones and carbs. And again, it was more like with the ketone salts where there was a null effect. So there's been a running time trial, several cycling time trials, and a lot of them showed no benefit of extra ketone ingestion. Now, I do think it's interesting to note that more recently, the group over in Belgium, led by Peter Hespel, started experimenting with combining ketone esters with bicarbonate, which is something that endurance athletes or, well, you know, I guess the intermediate distance athletes, right, you know, not are using anyway to sort of as a buffer. And the rationale there is that ketones create a mild metabolic acidosis. And so the idea was if you combine ketones with bicarb, you would buffer that extra acidosis coming from the ketones. And in that context, there was a synergistic and pronounced effect of ketones plus bicarbonate on performance of quite an ecologically valid study design where they, I think it was either a 2 hour or 3 hour pre-fatigue. And in that pre-fatigue, there was increases and decreases in intensity. Dr. Hespel designed that study. He's a lead physiologist for one of the Grand Tour cycling teams. So I have a lot of faith that he was designing a protocol that was quite good at mimicking the demands of a cycling race. So yes. They would do that pre-fatigue period and then a 15-minute time trial, which was meant to be like a final hill climb, and then a one-minute maximal time trial, so a sprint. So you'd kind of go pre-fatigue, short, very short break, 15 minutes, very short break, 1 minute sprint. And there was improvements in performance with ketones plus bicarbonate. So to me, it was quite exciting because I think that we don't really have the exact special sauce recipe of how to combine ketones for endurance performance just yet. You know, the exact how much and what type of carbohydrate we need to give it with. Does it work better given with bicarbonate? You know, one thing that the Belgian studies, the questions that they raised was that they gave the ketone at the start of the pre-fatigue period. and they only gave it that one time. So that by the time you actually got to the time trial, levels of ketones in the blood were really low.
Right.
And up until that point, you've heard me say a few times, well, I think it's really important that ketones reach a certain level to have any effect. And so what that study design suggests is that the ketones were having an effect in the pre-fatigue that was then like not necessarily, didn't need to be present during the time trial to improve performance. So, you know, we don't fully understand the best dose timing as well, you know, so it's a lot of questions. And whenever I speak about this, I like to remind people that, you know, from the conception of Gatorade as like, you know, the idea was we give people carbohydrates and we give them electrolytes. There was a lot of development and research that went into understanding the types of carbohydrate, maximal carbohydrate oxidation, you know, carbohydrate absorption, the right electrolytes, so many things. And, you know, we're still innovating now with products like Morton, like the pectin alginate and UCAN, like slower deliveries, all of those kind of things. We're still innovating mm-hmm. on top of carbohydrates. So with ketones, we're really at the start of that development process. And just because we haven't figured out quite the secret sauce just yet doesn't mean it doesn't work, but it's not yet at a stage where I, even as a ketone researcher, where I would say, you know, that everyone has to do it. The gains of some more established supplements and also of just proper sleep, hydration and nutrition are probably a bit more, you know, a bit more important for most mm-hmm. athletes than ketone supplementation right now, just because we're not quite sure how to use it.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, almost a little bit of myth busting right there, because sometimes that's not the not the message you hear on social media as much.
Yeah.
So coming from you, that's pretty powerful. Now, on the other hand, I have seen some pretty good data on a study that looked at overreaching in recovery. So I thought that this was interesting, and you know, maybe ketones will end up having a few niches, and perhaps you know, as you said, it's early days, so we don't necessarily know what they're going to be like from a strict performance perspective. But recovery does, in effect, you know, improve performance if you're consistently recovering mm-hmm. better. So we know that carbohydrates and protein play an important role with glycogen repletion and muscle protein synthesis. Where do you see ketone supplementation working well as far as like endurance athletes and overreaching and recovery? And could you speak to the study that did show improvements in recovery from an overreaching protocol?
Yeah, that's a really, really fascinating study that again came out of Peter Hespel's group over in Belgium. So, you know, good quality applied sports science research. And in that study, they progressively overloaded some untrained individuals or relatively untrained individuals and did periodic performance tests. And they saw that the group that was consuming ketones around each of their twice daily exercise training sessions was able to better perform in the later performance test in the later part of the protocol, which I can't remember whether it was 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and I don't want to be misquoted, but it was several weeks long. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, the common criticism of that study is that the research participants' diets were not controlled, and so actually what we saw in I think it was a 4 week study, and I think in the third week, as the performance started to diverge, the ketone group was consuming some more total energy and some more carbohydrate. And so a common criticism I see of people that, you know, want to be skeptical about this research is that, well, it might not have been the ketones that was causing the performance change, but it may have been just the overall increased energy intake. But I think that, and, you know, I've seen Peter speak about this, and he's of the opinion that ultimately, if it may have been the ketones that was driving the preserved energy intake, which ultimately drove the improved performance. So we can't really separate the two unless we redid that study and kind of did controlled feeding and made sure everyone ate exactly the same. But the effect on performance, maintaining performance and blunting several, to me as well as compelling about that study, was that there were several physiological measures that would normally indicate overreaching. So changes in resting heart rate and submaximal heart rate, and changes in some hormonal markers of stress that were positively influenced by ketones. So, or in the ketone ester group. So again, you know, can't definitively say whether it was the caloric intake or the ketones, but, you know, maybe the two are kind of somewhat linked. So is an area using ketones for recovery is an area I think is really promising based on our knowledge of the mechanisms of ketones for things other than being a fuel. So a lot of my research now focuses on how ketones can modulate inflammation and oxidative stress. And, you know, I'm sure you and I could have a whole separate conversation about, you know, whether or not you actually want to blunt oxidative, you know, whether you want to blunt the stress of training. I guess I always come back to my experience as an athlete, and I always remember that in January we used to have our first big work volume training camp of the year. It's halfway through the season, but start of the year, it was cold, it was dark, it was the time of year where I was competing as a lightweight, and we would start to have to bring down our body weight, and then we would have this huge load training camp, and then directly after that we would have a rowing machine test. And if you got through that and you were not sick and broken and, you know, like in a bit of a bad way, then that was a win in and of itself, because just going and trying to start lose weight and doing the first big volume block overseas was just always really, really brutal. So whenever I think about, you know, there are some times where the stress of the training and stresses of whatever's going on in life at that point, you know, for me, it was weight cutting as well. You know, that's a lot, and your own body is right on the limit. And so I think in regular training and training steady state, then athletes probably don't want to be blunting their adaptations, like by, you know, help, you know, off taking supplements that blunt oxidative stress or blunt inflammation, because we do know that those are important to drive adaptation. But sometimes in those really intensified work periods, especially if there's a performance piece coming hard on the heels, and, you know, you run the risk of tipping over that edge when you're beyond steady state, then maybe I think supporting the system a bit more in those intensified periods could be something that would be helpful. And I think that, you know, that study is a important kind of canary in the coal mine. I don't want to overweight on it, because, you know, it's that one study. And if we were just sitting here talking about that one Oxford study that showed improved performance, we'd be having a different conversation. And I think we need more evidence around ketones and recovery. The mechanisms all make a lot of sense. That study is very promising. I think it's a very exciting area that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, we can't get too far ahead of ourselves just yet. So I think I want to see some more research studies on that. And, you know, again, it's quite a low risk way of using ketones. It's not like if you take too much of a ketone ester before an important 10K run and you end up with some like GI issues and you screwed up that 10K run. Whereas if you're experimenting with ketones in your recovery, there's a, you know, a bit less downside, in my opinion. So actually, the way that I've been using ketones in my Ironman training is after my, you know, I have training for the full Ironman, I'll have a Saturday where I'll have a 5 or 6 hour ride followed by, you know, a 10 mile run. And then the next day I'll be going out and running 18 miles, and it's, you know, just a lot to do over 2 days. And so after the big workout on the Saturday, I'll often use ketones in the evening and to sort of help me be recovered for the long run the following morning. And, you know, I find that works quite well for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense what you're saying about, you know, that training camp. Sounds a little intense, by the way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in a situation like that, or like a, you know, a grand tour or something where you're racing for exactly 10 plus days, it's like you don't want to get sick, and you're, yeah, just riding that red line where you're really lean because, you know, you did that maybe on purpose, but then, you know, that comes with potential risk. So yeah, I could see why the role, you know, of ketones might be interesting there. But you make a good point, you know, it's still early days. And, you know, for that study in particular, we won't go on much longer on it, but I wanted to just mention one thing. You know, I think it's really important about the differences in diet. But what I thought was interesting is I've read some data that suggests ketones are glycogen sparing, a few studies specifically on that. And so you know, that would make me just ask the question. So, you know, in both situations, are people performing better because they're sparing glycogen? So therefore, at the end of the race, they have more in the tank. And also, like, are they recovering better because they're glycogen sparing? So yeah, that whole concept of glycogen sparing is really interesting in the grand picture of it. Is it significant?
Well, again, it depends which study you look at. So in the training study that we were just talking about, I don't think that, I'm trying to remember if they did muscle glycogen measures. If they did, I don't know that there was any significant difference, because there was a big discrepancy between the glycogen results from our Oxford study, where we did see a really profound glycogen sparing, and then another research study that we did at Oxford showed that ketones could help with glycogen repletion under somewhat artificial setting, where we infused a lot of glucose and we infused insulin and we did ketones on top of that. But in that setting, there was more glycogen resynthesis. So you had a couple of positive results there, and then a couple of results where, so in some of the more recent performance trials in Belgium, they've not seen a difference in muscle glycogen. And, you know, they say in their discussions of their paper that they think that the rich, carbohydrate-rich meal that they're giving people activates or primes them to break down the muscle glycogen better than coming in a otherwise pre-fasted state like we did in Oxford. So there's some research debate about, you know, whether or not the glycogen sparing that we saw in the Oxford studies was an artifact of the experimental setup, and whether under real ecological conditions, whether there is glycogen sparing. But I mean, there probably is an effect under some conditions. It would be consistent with the evolutionary role of ketones, which is to be an alternative to carbohydrate and spare carbohydrates during starvation. One thing, you know, that we've talked about and that I want to reemphasize again is that actually there would never be a situation in normal human physiology where you have both high carbohydrates and high ketones. So this is kind of
right.
It's fine and dandy to think about applying evolutionary thought patterns on top of this situation, but it's quite different. So it might not behave as we're expecting. I'm kind of on the fence as to if there's a glycogen sparing effect and how important it is. I've seen evidence that sort of, I believe, in both directions, and so I'm not quite sure under what context it occurs.
Okay. I wanted to ask also about cognitive elements of performance, so focus and agility, and then maybe we can move into ketones in the brain after this as well. Have there been any studies about mental performance?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think if there's more than one, but and I'm talking mainly about ketone ester work at this point, because I know that some of the studies of ketone salts have looked at cognitive performance and again found like generally null results. But there's a couple of studies with ketone esters that have shown promising positive results on in terms of cognitive function. So one study that was from Brendan Egan's group out in Ireland showed that cognitive performance degrades during exercise and that taking ketones mitigated that. Recently, I was a co-author on a study that looked at the effects of ketones during hypoxic exposure. So we put people on a rebreather that lowered the oxygen that they were breathing, and they had to complete cognitive testing. And again, we saw that ketones could mitigate the ketone ester drinks could mitigate that cognitive decline in hypoxia as well. And there's an old study actually that used a hypoglycemic clamp. So actually infusing insulin to lower people's blood glucose. And that means generally that cognitive performance decreases, and supplementing with ketones in that setting also improved cognitive performance. So I think that I would say that in a high stress situations where either energy or oxygen is limiting, ketones are probably going to provide extra fuel for the brain and improve cognitive performance. But in, you know, that high carb loaded athlete that we've talked about throughout this podcast, I wonder, you know, if there was not really like a strain on the system, a real strain, then maybe we wouldn't see a difference. But it does look like in an extreme least stressful situation that ketones could be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that that must be something that's super important in the military.
So that work that I just described with ketones and hypoxia was actually funded by the military to, you know, who are obviously interested in what happens in pilots if they have equipment malfunctions at altitude and trying to understand, you know, how to protect and mitigate against really those kind of worst case scenario kind of accidents.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating and frightening. Jeez. I wanted to also ask, do you think that there's, you know, with caffeine, there's, if you take more than, let's go to the very top of what the research has said, like 9 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, you know, there's that threshold where more is not better because you're blocking the adenosine receptors. But with ketones, do you think that there's a threshold at which point, like additional intake of ketones doesn't provide any improvement? Or is it possible that if you're in a nutritionally ketogenic state, that if you consume exogenous ketones, that that can impact your own body's ability to create ketones?
Okay, so that's kind of like two separate questions. So for the first part of that question, I absolutely think that there's a upper limit to, you know, to improvements and even safety with both natural ketosis, endogenous ketosis and exogenous ketosis. And if you remember back in the first question you asked me, I mentioned that the body, if you just fast continuously for days on end, the body will typically reach a plateau of around about 6 millimoles of ketones. And that's, you know, and if you have people on a ketogenic diet, you're not getting very many people that are up at that level or higher than that level. You know, there's a level that's achieved through dietary manipulation that is maybe 6, maybe a little higher, you know, that kind of ballpark. But if you start getting much higher than that, you're medically unwell and you're in hospital and it's ketoacidosis. So that's where even with diet, we see that. But I think that it'd be the same with exogenous ketones. And interestingly, in the last few months, I saw a case study, in a medical journal where some doctors had written in to describe a patient who did all of the things which, you know, sound really stupid when you say it back. She was fasting. She'd been fasting for 16 hours. She was trying to lose weight. She was on a low carb diet when she was eating. And then she took 2 times the recommended serving of a ketone ester, so a powerful exogenous ketone. She took 2 servings and she ended up in, she didn't die. She was, you know, she came around and was fine, but she was in hospital, like disoriented, nauseous, like medically not well. And that's when you stack like all of these stresses on the body together, it's not ideal. So I think you can overdose on ketones, but as you said, we can overdose on caffeine, we can overdose on, you know, simple sugars and end up glued to the toilet as well. So I think, you know, it's not something that makes me think that ketones are any different to any other nutrient that we can just take too much of or get a bit wrong. So because the thing is, with an exogenous ketone, your body's gonna, as we mentioned, start metabolizing it and clearing it and isn't continuing to make them itself. So it's, you know, it'll last for a few hours and then you should feel better. And honestly, like exogenous ketones tend to taste pretty strong, so if you have the stomach to drink 2 or 3 times the recommended serving, then like more power to you, and you're probably going to feel pretty rotten anyway. So yes, you can have too much, yes, you can probably overdose. I think it's kind of, you know, it's hard to do to overdose because they don't taste good. And then the second question, part of your question was, how does it kind of interact with our own natural ketone production? And so there's a couple of things to unpack here. Firstly, that when you have elevated levels of ketones in the blood, the way that the body normally stops ketone levels getting too high is that ketones are part of a what's called a feedback loop. So as ketone levels go up, they actually act to slow down fat release from the adipocytes, and that in turn would naturally decrease ketone production because there'd be less fat released from the adipocytes. That fat wouldn't be going to the liver and there'd be less ketone production. There's a negative feedback loop. So as ketone levels go up, ketones themselves inhibit their own production. So when you drink an exogenous ketone and you elevate your ketones in the blood, you're going to be in the short term blunting that fat release, that lipolysis component. And that's why I always kind of shake my head a little bit when I see people promoting exogenous ketones explicitly for weight loss or doing it in a kind of not sensitive way. Because I do think that as part of a calorie controlled diet, and if you're trying to be on a low carb diet, it could be helpful to occasionally use exogenous ketones as, you know, as a way to help you adhere to your diet. But I don't think that drinking ketones is like a fat melter or any of that other kind of ridiculous nonsense. You know, if you're in a state of endogenous ketosis where you're naturally making your own ketones, those ketones are coming from fat. But if I drink a bottle of ketone ester, the ketones in my blood have come from the ketone ester, and they are also going to be in the short term slowing down the lipolysis. So what I would say is that we suspect, it looks like from animal data, that even being in an exogenous ketosis can prime the body to be better at making ketones and better at metabolizing ketones. So even in a, this is animal work. So animals where we feed them a diet that's enriched in ketone ester, but not low in carbohydrate, we see changes in multiple tissues that mean that those animals look more like animals that are on a ketogenic diet. So in that regard, you might not be getting some of the weight loss, fat burning type benefits, but you might still be helping your body skew metabolism more towards that way, and getting some of the other sort of metabolic benefits of ketone metabolism. So it doesn't have to be an either or in this setting. Yeah. And one final nuance is that we've been working on a ketone ester at the Buck Institute in partnership with a company called Juvenescence, and that ketone ester is actually based on fat. And so it, rather than the other ketone esters that exist up to this point, they just break apart and release ketones directly into the blood. As whereas this ketone ester developed at Buck is fat based, so it breaks apart, and then the liver still needs to convert that fat to ketones. So we're getting one step closer to the more natural process, because you're actually really getting the liver to make its own ketones from this ester. So we think it's sort of one step closer to being like the natural process. So there's some innovations going on here, and I think it's likely that we're going to end up with different ketone esters being used for different things, having different effect profiles and efficacy profiles.
Oh, that's all super, super interesting. And so now I really want to keep going then and talk about how, actually, maybe you can tell me, what are you researching at the Buck Institute in regards to ketone supplementation? And is it only supplementation, or are you also investigating if it's nutritional ketosis and the brain? Because I know that that's your focus right now. And is there anything about healthy aging or concussions or any particular brain diseases that you're investigating?
Yeah, so I work in collaboration, or I'm a sort of a part of John Newman's lab at the Buck Institute. And Dr. Newman's research focuses a lot on brain diseases that are associated with aging. So Alzheimer's disease and delirium as well, which is an acute confusional state that occurs in older people, often when they're hospitalized. And so what Dr. Newman is doing is trying to see how ketone metabolism changes in those settings, and if supplementing with or boosting ketone boosting strategies, let's just say, if those are improve outcomes. And so to, you know, one of your points that you just raised in the question, we almost always look at both the ketogenic diet and ketone ester supplements, because we really want to try and understand if it's the process of fat metabolism, and whether ketones being present is sort of important or not, whether it's the low carbohydrate that's important, or whether it's the presence of ketones directly. So almost all of the experiments that we run will have a control diet, a ketogenic diet, and the ketone ester diet as well.
That's amazing.
I think it's really important to help us understand the mechanisms. And so without going into like tons of detail, there's a lot of really promising work with ketones and Alzheimer's disease that, you know, has been done by other labs, and even is starting to come through in clinical trials now. And so, for example, There's been some work done by an investigator called Stephen Cunane, who's up in Canada, and his lab has found that 6 months of supplementing with ketones in an MCT, medium chain triglyceride drink, so that's probably even less powerful than ketone salts. It's sort of just very mildly ketogenic, but they see that helps to improve brain energy status and also improves some measures of cognition as well in people with mild cognitive impairment, which is sort of the predecessor to Alzheimer's disease in many cases. So there's some really promising clinical work in this field, but what we're doing at Buck is really trying to understand what ketones are doing inside the brain that's causing those positive outcome changes that we see in terms of behavior and energy metabolism and things like that. And then, you know, it's sort of similar mechanisms with delirium. So this acute, in fact, delirium and concussion is sort of somewhat similar. Delirium is sort of you get an energy crisis in the brain that's triggered by inflammation, and with concussion you get an energy crisis in the brain that's triggered by impact and actual tissue damage. But in both those settings, it's interesting to understand if burning ketones as a fuel helps the brain to cope when inflammation and other sort of insults mean that glucose and carbohydrate metabolism is impaired. So in both those settings, the brain can get energy starved, and we think that ketones can prevent that energy starvation and preserve function. And then there's also an inflammation and oxidative stress component, which we talked a little bit about earlier in relation to recovery and some of these direct effects of ketones, where ketones are not just being used as a fuel, but they're actually interacting and binding to specific targets in the body a bit more like a drug than a typical fuel, but ketones will bind and actually change the activity of some of these proteins that are involved in immunity and change the expression of some genes that are involved with oxidative stress. So we're trying to, we use animal models of inflammation in older mice, and we put them in mazes and make them, run around in cages and things like that to see how anxiety behavior, for example, as well as cognitive performance, to try and understand if ketone strategies actually help in those settings. So I know there'll be some publications coming out of the lab in the next few months. The publication process is somewhat slow, but I'm, you know, peripherally involved, you know, a cheerleader and a thought partner, and not actually holding any pipettes or any mice myself, but kind of intellectually a part of that lab. And a lot of what I do is thinking about actually how we take the results from the lab and how we can run clinical studies that I do in partnership with Juvenescence, the company that's helping to, you know, scale up and commercialize the ketone ester that was developed at Buck.
Yeah, that is super interesting. It's much more interesting than the athletic side of ketones. I mean, it just feels like the impact outside of sport could be a lot more significant. And you know, what I think is interesting, and I'm curious what you think about this, is you've mentioned the role of ketones in the brain with inflammation. But if we think about aging in general and cellular senescence and just chronic low-grade inflammation, do you think just physiologically that there's a preventative role in taking ketones for anti-aging?
Well, I mean, if you ask me that when I'm writing a research grant, then I would say absolutely yes. And if you ask me that when you're like got me on the air and going on public record in a podcast, I'd probably be a bit more like cautious. But I mean, you know, it's an area that I think deserves a lot of attention. I've written research grants to look at this. We're really, really interested in trying to understand how, you know, ultimately not only does metabolic function degrade over time, but as you just mentioned, there's cellular senescence. And in the last sort of and inflammation and all of these things. And, you know, it's so exciting. It's such an exciting time to be thinking about ketones, because we already understand quite a lot about how they work in metabolism. And in the last 18 months or so, there's papers that have come out that have linked ketones directly to senescence. And in the last maybe like 5 years, a little bit longer, there's been loads of papers linking ketones to inflammation. And, you know, in a similar amount of time, maybe like 10 years, more papers linking ketones to oxidative stress. And all of these are, key processes and key pathways that are activated and or break down during aging. And so I think that what's, you know, the way I like to think about ketone bodies, and this is something that my mentor, John Newman, has really helped me in sort of like kind of finessing in my mind. It's like, you know, if you want to treat age-related disease, you have to manipulate multiple pathways. Sometimes, you know, a monotherapy type approach that just goes to one receptor, it's not going to be powerful enough because so many processes break down and change as we age. And what I love about the idea of the, you know, the possibility and the potential of harnessing ketone biology is that it is tapping into something that is very natural. I think that, you know, really it was not that long ago in our evolutionary history that we would have all been going through periods of ketosis much more regularly, like food security and, mm-hmm. you know, the access to food and the types of food that we have now. It's really, you know, a modern phenomenon. And I think that there have been seasons where we'd have been in ketosis much more, or we'd have been in ketosis every few days because we'd have not always been able to find breakfast, or
right.
you know, all things like that. So I think that for me, looking at ketone supplements, ketone esters, and even fasting and things like that as ways to reinstall these, you know, natural metabolic pathways back into our biology and the implications of that for aging. It's like very, very exciting. And, you know, the way I like to think about this is that there's so many conditions that are being investigated right now for the efficacy of ketones in those conditions. And if just one or two of them work out, then that's a huge success. And, you know, I really hope in the end of my career to see ketones having a positive impact on one or more of these age-related diseases and helping people live better and live longer.
Absolutely, because it's one thing to live longer, but you want the quality of the life to be good, right? So
absolutely. Nobody wants to live to 120 if they're still, you know, disabled from age 70. You only want to live that much longer if you're going to get the health span to match the lifespan. So, you know, we've got to address both of those as we think about healthy aging.
Oh, for sure. I'm getting to the last question, but I have to ask because COVID is everywhere. I almost feel like there could be application here. And I'm curious if your lab has ever even considered research in that area.
Oh, I wrote a huge review on it for Cell Medicine last year. Yeah. the review was... we were trying to be tactful about it. I'm going to probably get the title kind of wrong, but I think it was something along the lines of, you know, investigating ketosis as a immunometabolic countermeasure for respiratory viruses. You know, I don't think we called out COVID specifically in the title, but we used COVID and influenza as an example throughout because, there was a ton of interesting mechanistic overlaps. And, you know, we were hoping that the paper would, there was too much work for our lab to do ourselves. And so we were hoping that writing the paper would sort of set off some investigations. And I do know that some people did clinical trials of ketogenic nutrition for COVID, to treat COVID. And, you know, I mean, the problem is research has a long lead time. So there may have been other things that actually kind of went on during COVID that I haven't heard about yet, and that we may hear about in the coming months. But we definitely had some ideas to test. We have not been able to test as many of them as I'd have liked, but it's people should, if they don't mind technical reading, they should go away and look at the paper and kind of get a bit of an idea about how we were thinking about ketones modulating infection. But I mean, I think that, you know, we were talking about athletic performance and I was saying it's going to be very context specific and maybe hard to dial in. I think that with COVID, it's or any viral infection, this is, you know, multiplied by 10 because the timing of where you are in terms of the immune response, it's going to make a big difference as to whether you want to be impairing that, you know, cytokine storm versus allowing your natural innate immunity to kind of kick in. So it's probably a pretty nuanced question, and I really didn't like it when people were reading anything into like what I said as to mean like go out and start giving ketone esters to people with COVID, because I don't think we understand enough about exactly the timing or, you know, the context behind that. So I think it's promising, but to be handled with some caution.
Yeah, for sure. I was just curious because, you know, I've read a lot of articles about just vascular concerns and so much around the brain with COVID. So I was wondering.
So we wrote in the paper, we split it into two sections. In the first section, we talked a lot about cellular mechanisms, so inflammation, oxidative stress, viral replication, some, you know, sort of very small, on a small scale, cell scale. And then the second half of the paper, we talked about brain hypoxia and sarcopenia and muscle wasting when people are in the ICU, and also cardiac function and heart problems that occur when people are hospitalized with COVID, and sort of talking more on a systems level of the evidence supporting ketones to protect each of those systems individually. So there's both a cellular and a systems argument for ketones in that kind of infection, but it's very mostly hypothetical and not very, you know, well fleshed out with evidence yet, but all of the hypotheses and mechanisms are really nice.
Yeah, that's great. Well, this has been amazing. We've covered so much. I'm really glad that we went through the differences between natural ketosis and then supplementing with ketones exogenously. And then the doses, super helpful for anyone listening. Go back and then considering measuring your ketone levels. A little bit of myth busting there. And I really like how you've clearly noted that ketones are, you know, they're a tool, right? So they're not necessarily your main go-to, like eating carbohydrates or maybe taking creatine or nitrates or more of the established sports nutrition supplements, but they're a tool and they're in the early days, and there's some promising, interesting research in all areas that we discussed today. And personally, I'll be following along the brain research as well, because I think that's super interesting. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you wanted to mention?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground, and I'm sure people are probably reeling a little bit and need to go away and digest. Also, because I know I speak at 100 miles an hour, so maybe they'll have to slow me down a little bit using their podcast app rather than speed up like I normally do with people that I listen to.
No, you're amazing. Thank you. So I just wanted to ask you the last question that I ask every guest, and it's a little bit more about you and the name of the podcast, which is Imperfect Progress. And I chose the name because I myself love science, and I also like the struggle of this thing called life that we have. And both of them are very imperfect, right? So you're always, you know, research is difficult and you find something out, you might kind of take a while to progress and maybe regress and whatnot. But I know that you've had a really interesting path as an athlete, you've been a very successful athlete and researcher, but it goes without saying that everyone runs into some adversity in their life. So you are doing amazing. I love the work you're doing at the Buck Institute now, and you've come a long way in your research. And I'm really curious, how have you been able to overcome obstacles along the way in your path? Because I always find that it's so amazing to hear everything about what you're researching, but it's also interesting to hear about you, the human being, and, you know, how you got to where you are today. And maybe someone listening can hear your answer to this and it can help them, because I find that it's often the most interesting, you know, question in the podcast, in a sense, because everyone just shares a little bit of their way through adversity. So how would you think about how you navigate your way in life through imperfect progress?
Yeah, it's a big question. So I think the first thing is accepting that, you know, as you sort of said, everyone's going to meet with adversity. And, you know, I, at this point, I expect things to not work out at some point, you know, whether it's the first time, you the fact that progress is imperfect is just, that's just the nature of the beast. So not really beating yourself up too much if things are going wrong. You know, you just have to be in the moment and, you know, problem solve and make the best of that moment. And something that one of the sports psychologists said to me that, you know, resonated a lot while I was rowing was, if it's a 3 out of 10 day, make it a 3 out of 3 day rather than a 3 out of 10 day. And I always just, like, you know, if you're having a bad day, let's try and make it the best bad day that you can, rather than sort of wallowing in the fact that you'd rather it was a 10 out of 10 day. So expect that there's going to be hardship. When hardship arrives, try and make the best of what you've got. And then the other thing is always making some kind of progress. And another like mantra, and I can't remember when this came to me or who said this, but it was can't do nothing, got to do something. And it's often, you know, there's not that many settings where, you know, being paralyzed for a long time. I'm not saying don't take time to stop and think, you know, that's important as well, but think actively. If you are not, you know, if you don't start making some kind of decisions and making some kind of progress, then paralysis, I think, for me is what I'm always trying to avoid. So, you know, you've got to try and, it doesn't need to be frantic paced. And, you know, I think I want to emphasize, you do need time to stop and think sometimes, but try and avoid getting stuck in a vicious cycle or a rut, because, you know, if there's something wrong, you got to try and fix it. Before you can make progress. And yeah, I think I don't really feel like I was ever the most talented athlete. I was always sort of like fourth place, third place, all the way up through school. And then even, you know, when I was on the British international team, I wasn't the top ranked lightweight athlete. And it was always, everything was always sort of holding on by my fingernails and a bit of a struggle. But so long as you keep on holding on and keep showing up and keep persevering, then a hard work can outweigh a lack of like being a naturally talented star. And you know, you can get there. And I see that a lot with my Ironman training now as well. You know, if you just show up and you put in the hours day after day, even when you feel kind of grotty and you don't really want to do it, like triathlon's one of those nice ones where hours in really does often equal outcome out the other end. So I think that, you know, just keep showing up, keep persevering, don't it sounds very cliched, don't give up, just keep going after your vision and your dreams. And it always looks very effortless for people from the outside. I feel like people look at me and where I've gotten to and they think that it must be, you know, maybe they think it was difficult sometimes, but you have to work really, really hard. And also I also have days where I don't want to get up off the couch, or where I don't want to, you know, where I'm not motivated. So that's normal as well. I think we, especially on social media, we only see the, and on, say, Strava or any of those platforms, you know, social media, Twitter, whatever, for a scientist, and Strava for an athlete, you sort of only see that sort of side of people that they want you to see. So even people who are good, you know, you look up to and they're good at what they do, they're going to have bad days as well. So it's just how you deal with them and the net amount of good days that you can stack up. Another little, you know, mantra or thought pattern that I had was, you know, trying to make more right decisions than wrong decisions, more net positive. Because especially being a lightweight, you know, it'd be like, oh, am I going to have that cookie? And if you have the cookie because you feel like sad and it makes you feel better, then maybe that's the right decision for that time. But maybe not having the cookie the next day when you're just kind of in a rush and you need to grab a snack, then like, no. So there's not, you know, just, you just want to make the balance of good decisions more than the balance of less good decisions. You want to be in positive credit with the good decisions. So doesn't mean eliminating all bad ones. I mean,
I love it. Yeah. That's amazing. I think I love like just show up, right? Paint that on my wall. No, I appreciate you being so human. And even just, you know, when you said some days I just don't want to get off the couch, like, it's actually refreshing to hear, you know, because you're right. You just assume everyone's just rocking their career and every day is awesome. And it's like, ah, she's human too. You know, it is actually really refreshing.
Very,
to hear
very human, very human. And everyone is, no matter what, no matter what they paint. And I've been in Silicon Valley and I've heard CEOs give pictures and be like, I do this and I do that. And I have my cold shower and then I take this and this and that. And then I meditate and, you know, like, yeah, they do that one day a week. And then, you know, I've been away on vacation with some of those people and they're there, you know, lounging. And you're like, okay, you know, you've got the pitch that you say that you do every single day, and maybe you do it sometimes but not all the time. So
hopefully more good decisions than worse, right?
Yeah, net, that's always a net more good decisions.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share all of your expertise and even answer the last question. I really appreciated that. And yeah, I'm looking forward to sharing this. And where can people learn more about the work that you're doing?
So the best place to connect with me and follow me is on Twitter. I'm at Brianna Stubbs. And there you can also find the Buck Institute, John Newman and Eric Verdin tweet a lot about metabolism, ketone metabolism, aging metabolism, all of that kind of stuff. The company that we've been working with, Juvenescence, is on Twitter and Instagram as well. So you can see some of the products that we've been developing together and the research that we've been doing together. Twitter is generally the best place, I think, for science communication. And that's probably the best place to reach me. I try and stay off social media otherwise, because I find it's a bit of a time sink.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I truly appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
Absolutely. Take care. Thank you so much for listening. And I hope you thought that was as insightful as I did. Super interesting. I really appreciated the information about dosing. And I hadn't heard that detail before, so that was insightful for me. And so many other things that Dr. Stubbs talked about. I'm really intrigued with the newer research on brain health and healthy aging. And I'm sure a lot of you listening are as well. I'll be sure to share some links to some of the papers and even products that Dr. Stubbs talked about today. Besides that, I would really appreciate if you could take a moment right now and head over to Apple Podcasts and just leave a short comment about this episode in particular, what you thought about it. So for anyone else that wants to see some feedback, that's always super helpful. Or a comment on any episode that you've listened to. I find the feedback super informative, and it helps me to sometimes make changes, or sometimes I get recommendations for other guests or topics that you might be interested in. And also give the podcast a rating. And what that does is it gets more eyes on the podcast. And for me, that's super important, because my goal is to get these messages that these experts have out into the world. There's so much misinformation and pseudoscience out there that for me, it's important to take this science that often just sits within the scientific community. And what I want to do is translate it and make it super accessible for everyone to hear and put it to use in your lives, because, you know, that's why the science is done. So I really appreciate if you could do that. That would be awesome. And besides that, stay tuned for my next episode. And remember, the name of the podcast is Imperfect Progress, and that's because progress in science is imperfect, progress in life is imperfect. But that last question that I always ask my guests, I just find so interesting, because it really helps us to, you know, remember that everyone navigates through struggles differently. But I think every guest I've ever asked, the bottom line is, you know, you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other, in particular through the most difficult times. So if you are struggling with something right now, just remember that, you know, it can be overwhelming and the struggle is real, but through that struggle, you will learn something, and that will help you grow. And really, that is the whole purpose of the journey. So keep putting one foot in front of the other. Know that everyone wants the best for you, and that if you're struggling, good things are coming. And you have to believe that and have hope. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon.